Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today, and I just learned on Twitter that some listeners like this formula, and I don't really need to change it up. We'll hear from Heather Berg, author of the book Porn Work, about laboring in that field, and then from Kevin Young and Leonard Seabrook, co-authors of a paper on the contrasting organizational styles of the Chicago free marketeer and Cambridge, Massachusetts centrist Keynesian schools of economic thought. Most analyses of sex work study it from the consumption side, how viewers and customers experience the product, what it does to us as a society, or how it affects individuals' views of human relations. Here's a different perspective from Heather Berg, assistant professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at Washington University in St. Louis, and author of the book Porn Work, published by the University of North Carolina Press. It's not screamingly new, it was published a year ago, but hey, we're not hung up on commercial norms here on Behind the News. Berg looks at the people who make porn, how workers see their work, and how they fight to maximize their control over their conditions of labor. How much of an escape from the world of wage labor is it? How free or unfree do the performers feel? How has the transformation of the industry from the era of blurry stag films to today's DIY world of OnlyFans affected the people who make it? Heather Berg. Reading your book reminded me of an old friend of mine on first hearing the term culture workers, snarling, "We got into culture so we didn't have to work."
Yes.
Is porn something like that?
Yeah, I love that. I think it really can be. Folks get into porn often so they don't have to work and often find a lot of work on the other side. But one of the things I'm trying to hold on to in the book is that initial refusal still matters.
Most writing on porn and a lot of stuff on sex work generally has focused on the consumption side, the effects on those who watch it, what does it mean for human relations, those sorts of things. But you're looking at, to use the Marxist terminology, relations of production, boss-worker, conditions of labor, things like that. Why do you think there's so little attention paid to the people who actually produce the stuff?
Yeah, I think, part of it, and this is something that I started to do as I got deeper into the research, is to read writing on porn, whether it be academic or journalistic, then kind of get clues as to whether the author imagined themselves more as a consumer or as a worker. Part of this is about sex work stigma and also about how hard it is for sex workers to gain footing in the academy. But so often you can read this work and get a pretty clear idea that the author imagined themselves in the position of either primary consumers, so people who watch porn, or what we might call secondary ones. So often, anti-porn feminists imagine themselves there, people who will be impacted because others watch porn.
But not much interest in the workers.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Part of that is the old questions about reification, but I do think a lot of it has to do with the class locations of the people who write in the first place.
They're much more comfortable with consuming than producing, or don't see themselves as producers.
Right. Yeah.
Early on in the book, you quote Sylvia Federici saying that independent sex work is a problem for capitalism because it evades the wage relation. To a lot of people, anti-porn feminists, Christian moralists, whatever, see it as deeply exploitative, quite the opposite of evading the wage relation. How do you reconcile those points of view?
Yeah, I think I might turn the question back on them and ask how they reconcile a nominally anti-capitalist position with imagining that some forms of work are less exploitative because they're not stigmatized. So I think that's really my interest in that question is where that's coming from, why it is that so many people who call themselves anti-capitalists and leftists still hold on to the idea that sex work is uniquely and singularly exploitative. Any of us on the left should know that is the nature of work, frankly, whether or not it's waged. And Federici also says that even work that is outside the wage is a site of exploitation. Sex worker leftists have often made the argument that the state is the pimp in that case, or the boss. And so I think all of that matters. I'm not saying that this is outside of capitalism, but it can be outside the wage, and that makes a material difference in people's everyday lives.
Now, the industry has really undergone three major transformations over the decades in its economic model. going back to the early days of film. There were stag films, very anonymous. You barely saw the faces of the actors, certainly no personalities or stars. Then we had that moment in the 70s when porn went mainstream. People learned the names Linda Lovelace, Harry Reams. The industry developed kinds of stars. And now we're in this world of OnlyFans and Pornhub, which is, to some degree, do-it-yourself stuff. So could you talk about the evolution of the industrial model of porn over the years?
The biggest piece that I'm interested in is thinking about that evolution through the lens of workers' struggles, again, to free themselves from managerial control. So what that's looked like, and here there's a really an important difference in comparison to other platform labors, where porn's evolution to the platform isn't coming from tech disruptors from the top down. It's not app developers figuring out how to better disrupt real estate markets or rideshare companies, things like that. Instead, it's been workers who have been figuring out really creative and smart ways to subvert, again, the wage relation, to subvert the dynamics in which directors and producers used to maintain copyright and the sole ability to cut up scenes into little pieces to resell them in perpetuity while only having paid performers a day rate. So sex workers have figured out how to subvert that, how to gain more control over their everyday lives, over working conditions, but also over pay. And that is really the story of the transition from the studio model to OnlyFans in particular. And it also has its beginnings in the earlier moments that you mentioned, where we have, you know, under what you talked about in the 1970s, we have what folks call the golden era. But even in those moments, people were trying to self-produce. It was just harder because technologies for production were so much more expensive and the mechanisms of distribution were a lot less democratic. So this historical move has been a move to greater autonomy in some ways, and then also lessened autonomy in others, particularly as porn workers navigate increasing state regulations, particularly around their ability to get paid through payment processors. That's my quick answer.
Okay, let's talk some about the work site. And of course, there are many different kinds of work sites. So there's an array of different experiences here. But what about the balance between consent and coercion? I think to a lot of critics of the industry, it's just nothing but coercion, either, you know, directly on the set or broader economic coercion. How much consent is there involved in the production?
It depends on the production model. So when people are self-producing, of course, then the dynamics of consent are really about what Marx called the dull compulsion of the wage, and that's the story in much studio work too. And in that, the ways that life under capitalism undermines consent are not different from folks working in retail or the grocery store, secretarial work, healthcare, teaching, the kinds of jobs that a lot of foreign workers left before they came to the industry. So I'm really interested in why so many commentators fixate on a lack of consent in this context. I think there's a lot to say about whether sex makes things different. And I really refuse to come down on one side or the other on that in the book, because for some workers, it does. For some, the dull compulsion of the wage in the sex work context does feel more compelling. And for others, you know, a lot of people in the book talk about the ways that this feels less, not just less exploitative sometimes, but also that they have more control and more ability to maneuver around consent and negotiation than they did in other working class jobs.
And what about feelings? Sex, of course, does have some association with human emotions. What are the effects of having sex with people they may or may not like? Is it all in a day's work? How do they manage the complexities of the emotions that would arise in the work?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, it varies. So for some people, there's a lot of emotion management that's required in order to get through a day. Some people talk about, again, I think really creative techniques around temporary disassociation, which, again, from an outside perspective, seems like a terrible tactic to get through your work day, but which is something that a lot of working class people and, you know, folks in white collar jobs too, deploy in order to get through all sorts of circumstances. So I want to be really careful not to be precious around the uniqueness of sex here, and also to acknowledge that for some people it is special. But I think one thing that often gets lost is the reality that for often commentators' primary site of concern here is straight women, or at the very least women who do straight sex work. And what a lot of these women will tell you is that being socialized into heterosexuality means already managing your emotions around sex. It means already figuring out how to perform according to markets, paid and otherwise. And so for a lot of people, the only difference when we enter into paid sex is that there's money at the end of it. And so the emotion management piece isn't unique here.
Yeah, day-to-day life is such a realm of freedom, isn't it? The money issue is interesting. To anti-porn types, money makes it all bad. But there are countering views. You quote one performer saying it protects boundaries, staves off burnout. Charlotte Shane likes the sex because it brings in cash. How does money enter into the social relations here?
Right. I'm really fascinated by the ways that porn workers, again, especially either straight women or women who do straight sex work, talk about money as the thing that makes sex worth it. And in some ways, it's a really fascinating intervention into long-running conversations and even radical feminist thought around the kind of thanklessness of straight sex for people. And so I'm really interested in this moment in contemporary anti-porn feminist thought and anti-sex work feminist thought in general, where the argument seems to be that free sex is better. And I'm fascinated by the ways that in that anti-sex worker feminists match up in their interests exactly with the worst kind of Johns, the worst kinds of porn fans, and also the worst kinds of porn managers in imagining that people shouldn't get paid to do their work. So that's one thing I'll say about the role of money. But yeah, and in a more practical sense, negotiation can give folks a lot of room to maneuver around really calculating in a sober way what their boundaries are, what pay makes a given encounter feel, again, worth it. And I'm really of the belief that if a lot more straight women did that, sexual relations would improve, not necessarily with money at the end of the day, although sometimes, but to really ask sober questions about what they're getting from an encounter. So again, I'm answering that from the perspective of straight sex, because that's so often what commentators are interested in when they pose it.
Yes, it's as if a lot of people seem to have forgotten critiques of bourgeois marriage that see it as a form of prostitution, only legal.
Exactly, right, exactly.
Now, what about pleasure or joy in the work? It's not a question one asks of an office worker or a line cook very often. You know, it's just a job. But how about porn? There's certainly at least the appearance of pleasure involved. How do they experience that?
Yeah. And I'll say that this is an evolution for me in writing the project. I think because of my kind of allergy to consumer-focused accounts, I came into the writing process not really wanting to talk so much about the pleasure piece, because from what was at the time for me a kind of more orthodox Marxist position, I was thinking of this as not a material concern, as something that was mainly of interest, again, to consumers and to folks thinking from that perspective. But porn workers pushed back against that in all sorts of ways and invited me to listen in ways that I'm really grateful for. And so there are a couple things I'll note. One is that for some people, and this is often absolutely unrelated to the performance of pleasure that you see on screen, but there can be real pleasures in the work. Sometimes those are sexual, and sometimes those are camaraderie, you know, friendship with other workers, the pleasure of creative performance, the pleasure of being watched. I mean, that can matter. But in terms of the sexual pleasure piece, I always return to this quote from Connor Habib, who features really centrally in the book, who in the most gentle way was kind of bringing me up short on my initial refusal to think about these questions. And he said, you know, I get to give and receive pleasure every day, which makes this different. It makes it different from straight, mainstream, or non-sex work in that, and I'm quoting him again here, that is giving and receiving misery. And for some people, there's plenty of misery to be had in porn too, more likely everyday tedium. But for a lot of folks, the pleasure piece is a huge part of the workday, and I came to understand that as a working condition on its own terms.
I'm speaking with Heather Berg, author of Porn Work, published by the University of North Carolina Press. You quote one performer, I believe a male performer, saying he fell in and out of love 1,000 times.
Yeah,
that was really charming. But yeah, so that's something that, you know, a lot of critics would not even imagine.
No, that's Herschel Savage, who was in Debbie Does Dallas and hundreds of other films. And I found that such a charming moment. And again, this is at this moment in our conversation where he was kind of gently pushing back on some of the language that I was using. So I had been talking about this in just kind of very meat and potatoes terms, like thinking about the skill or, you know, how do you manage emotions? And he's like, you know, there's actually something more, you know, more complicated and more messy, but also sometimes more tender going on here. And it's not just for the boss and it's not just for the consumer.
An experience you wouldn't have as a fry cook.
Right. But also I think, and you said at the top of your question here that these aren't questions we ask of other workers, and I wonder if maybe we should. And I'm really interested in workplace sabotage in general and the kind of daily ways that workers wrest back some pleasure. So I hope that fry cooks are finding that too, whether that's sexual or not, or pilfering food, whatever, messing with the food. But these acts of play at work, I think, you know, have a huge impact on what it feels like to get through a shift.
What about the distinction between like cool, hip, alternative, feminist porn and a more mainstream kind? Is that a fruitful distinction to make?
Yeah, well, I think probably listeners can tell in the tone of your question and certainly in how I'll answer it that I don't think it is. And I'm guessing maybe that you don't either.
No, I thought that was a very interesting point you made. So I wanted you to bring it out. Yeah.
Yeah. So I too would maybe give scare quotes around the hip, ethical, feminist and queer. For me, you know, the distinction matters insofar as the representational politics can be different, and that matters for some consumers. It also really does matter for some performers who get into sex work, yes, to make a living, but like all of us, make choices about the kinds of work that they do that are in line with their politics. And for some people, showing queer love, showing different bodies, different storylines matters. And I don't want to pretend that that's not true. In terms of everyday working conditions, in terms of pay, the length of a shoot, the kinds of control that you have over what a scene looks like, those labels can mean more for marketing than they can for actually experiencing the work on the ground. And on the other hand, one place, unfortunately, where those marks of distinction really do make a difference is that people in self-defined ethical porn, queer and feminist porn, often make a lot less. So I liken it often to, you know, to working at a nonprofit. There's this sense, or in academia, really, there's a sense that if you're doing work that is politically motivated, that you'll get paid less for it.
Speaking of academia, I liked your conversation describing being an adjunct to a performer. It's like, you know, just quit.
Right. Yeah. She just thought I was just letting myself be exploited in such an extreme way.
Also, there's danger with the cool, hip, feminist alternative porn. Doing what you love can be a sinister thing as well as it can be, you know, a liberating thing.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think where I come down in the book is that it's both, of course. And one thing that I want to push back on in terms of the broader discourse and creative labor in particular is this tendency, I think, to read that as a kind of gotcha, you know, the sense that people enter into work that they love in order to escape alienation. Alienation finds them in new ways. And so there's sometimes a sense in the writing that people were stupid to try to escape it in the first place. And for me, that's not at all true. Yeah, I'm interested in the desire to escape, even if the escape is limited on the other side.
Now, we touched on this a little bit with the pay scale on alternative porn, but this is an industry with enormous hierarchies of race and sex, right? I mean, even starker than the non-porn world.
I don't know that I would say they're starker. I mean, if you look at the numbers in terms of racist pay inequality in civilian or straight work, those inequalities are absolutely marked. And in some ways, you have a little more room to maneuver in porn because you can self-produce, you know, which isn't true in, again, you know, say retail work. But yeah, the what that looks like in porn is that you could be doing exactly the same job as someone else, even on the same set, and be making less for it. And that obviously has a whole lot of material implications for the kinds of work that people feel pushed to accept, for, you know, how much people have to work in order to make a living. But it also has a lot of psychic and emotional ones, and folks talked about what it feels like, for example, as a Black performer to work in a scene, to have a sex scene with someone who is being paid not just more than you, but a premium in order to be seen on screen with you. The kind of emotional labor required to pull that off is immense.
Black performers often fetishize for his or her Blackness.
That's right.
But that doesn't result in a pay premium.
No, and in fact, one of the rationales for lower pay that white and frankly non-Black in general, not just white, but the non-Black managers, so agents, producers, and directors gave me is, you know, it's the market, right? It's never their own racist decision making. But the market is actually fascinated by the fetishization of Blackness, and our quote, urban and interracial content is hugely popular. And this is something that Marae Miller Young talks a lot about in her book, Taste for Brown Sugar. But there absolutely is a market, and people are paying for this content. It's just that the managers, in their own way, algorithmic managers, too, figure out ways to pay Black performers less.
Now, what about the career path? This is an industry that values youth. You can be old at 30. Do performers move on to managerial or production roles? Or, what do people do over time? Is it just something you do temporarily and then move on to something else?
Yeah, and that's true for a lot of people. A lot of folks do move on to managerial roles, although that has become, in really generative ways, disrupted with the move to digital and direct-to-consumer distribution through platforms like OnlyFans. People have longer careers when they're not dependent on the kind of sclerotic ideas of good old boy agents and producers about what sells. But even prior to that digital turn, the kind of transition from Babysitter Next Door to MILF was certainly, circumscribed, but there is a lot of work for folks, especially for women over 30. So in some ways, I think sometimes the ideas about what's called aging out are disproportionate to the realities on the ground. But it's absolutely true that one's type and kind of your place in the market changes quicker here than it would elsewhere, especially for women, less so for men.
Now, what about state regulation, wage and hour regulation, occupational safety stuff? Is that a good or a bad idea for this industry?
In some ways, whether it's a good or a bad idea is somewhat moot, I think, for two reasons. One, because most porn performers are not employees, and many don't want to be, precisely because of these moves against working under a boss, these moves to self-produce. Most people don't want, they'd rather have no bosses at all than bosses that are disciplined by the state. And obviously that's an uncomfortable reality for the left, but it's one I think we have to take seriously. So there's that. And another point that I make in the book that I think is worth noting is that most wage and hour law for all sorts of working class jobs, especially precarious and contingent ones, is unenforced. So, you know, I think there are areas in which the state could be doing a lot better, absolutely. But in many cases, it's a kind of an abstract discussion because the law is not enforced in the first place. And again, most performers calculate that it's not a trade-off that makes sense for them to be subservient to a boss in order to maybe gain protection under labor law that is weak and often unenforced.
What about class dynamics in this world? The porn performer is certainly not in the textbook bourgeois proletarian role.
Right.
But neither is that absent. And DIY porn may look like independence, but can also involve a great deal of self-exploitation, you know, having to work around the clock, basically promoting yourself all the time. So how do we think about class in porn, and did it change how you see class more generally?
Yeah, it changed a lot for me. I came in wanting to tell a more traditional Marxist labor history of this industry and thinking about workers as workers and their struggles against bosses. And it just became so clear very quickly that one of performers' best tools for resisting exploitation is to release themselves from working class status in the classical sense, which is to say working for a wage under other people. And so if I came into this story, and you know, my politics have always been aligned with workers as such, it would have been inappropriate for me to ignore that one of these preferred tactics is to not be a worker, right? So thinking about how to wrestle with that became a really important piece of the project. But yeah, it has all sorts of implications for what solidarities look like in the industry, such as it is, for people's ideas, to your last question, for people's ideas about what regulation should look like, and also for their own understanding of their class location vis-a-vis their comrades, but also their bosses. So the kinds of traditional lines don't look the same here, and I want to take that seriously as an opening in addition to something that makes class messy here.
And do you see any union organizing in the field?
If most performers would rather not have a boss than one disciplined by the state, they would also rather not have a boss than one disciplined by collective bargaining. That's not to say that there's not a lot of really vibrant collective action happening here, but it is, and I'll quote someone who's not in the book, but who I'm in community with more broadly, Lauren Kiley, who talks about the importance of organizing for workers, not against bosses. And I think that's a really crucial frame and really importantly put in this context. So the kinds of organizing that you see, they look like mutual aid, they look like information sharing, but in this moment in the industry's evolution, it's really, there's no one boss against which folks would organize. Instead, this proliferated community of performers, but also self-producers, is putting a ton of organizing energy around organizing against hostile policy that's coming not from their bosses, but from the state. And often I think that gets understood from civilian leftists as a kind of libertarian position, but I think that's the wrong take. So traditional forms of unionizing, sometimes there are efforts, often civilian leftists grab onto those with a lot of excitement because they're really happy to see forms of organizing that feel familiar to them. But I'm really in favor of always, you know, meeting people where they're at, which is in this case that those forms of organizing just aren't the priority.
I like that use of civilian industry jargon. Finally, what about the issues of what the business press calls work-life balance? I would imagine they're pretty complicated in this world.
Yeah, I mean, I think a couple of things I'll say there. One, and there's definitely a double bind here, but a lot of people get into porn and other sex work in order to grasp at some semblance of work-life balance. They then find that undermined in different ways in the industry. But one thing that people say again and again is that working a 9-to-5 and certainly working the variable schedules of a lot of, hourly working class jobs is just absolutely incompatible with anything like real work-life balance. So that becomes particularly an issue for caretakers, for people with disabilities and chronic illness, for students, you know, but also for people who want time to pursue their art or their band or whatever. So the kind of impossibility of work-life balance in a lot of civilian jobs is a huge driver of entrance into the sex industry in the first place. But then you do find, round-the-clock work in some ways, and also just a kind of obliteration of boundaries between life and work that people figure out all sorts of ways to manage, but that can be, you know, really straining, not just in terms of the kind of day-to-day emotional costs of that, but there are particularly for folks who work out of their homes and who have to very carefully calibrate how much of their personal lives to reveal to fans. There are important safety issues at hand as well. So there's these questions of hours, but also these other, I think, sometimes more amorphous boundaries between working and living.
That was Heather Berg, Assistant Professor of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Washington University in St. Louis, and author of the book Porn Work, Sex, Labor, and Late Capitalism, published by the University of North Carolina Press. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. I wish I had this song for last week's interview with the crypto critic Molly White, but I only discovered it the other day, and what a catchy, fun thing it is. It's written by and features Salem Elise, a 22-year-old singer, songwriter, and TikTok sensation from Mill Valley, California, with the assistance of artists only identified as Sad Alex and July the Ginny, in order of appearance. This is I Don't Care About Your Crypto Boy by Salem Elise.
Mention NFTs one more time, and it's guaranteed when I can tonight. You got open sea on your mind, and it should be me that you prioritize. Tryna get through, but it's all for you. Cause you're busy aiming for the dumb room. You think I'm enthused, but I got some news for you. I don't care about your crypto. Yet. We could be so rich, but I won't take it to the moon if you don't wanna come with. I need that fast life, you're making mixtapes, so please enlighten me, huh? I'm so damn delusional, babe. You're a musician, you work at Arby's, that's why I ain't what you say.
That was I Don't Care About Your Crypto Boy by Salem Elise. And now a rather radical shift from sex work to academic economics. Mainstream economics in the U.S. from the 1950s through the 1970s was dominated by a battle between two schools of thought. On the center left was a mainstream form of Keynesianism, which sought to tame the business cycle through government policy and temper the excesses of capitalism, without ever thinking of transcending it, through regulation and a modest welfare state. It was based in two economics departments in Cambridge, Massachusetts, those of Harvard and MIT. On the right was the competing Chicago school centered in that university, with Milton Friedman as its star. As the 1970s progressed, the Massachusetts crew, which my interviewees dubbed the Charles River School, was overtaken by the free marketeers of Chicago. Of course, much of that shift was driven by the changing politics of the era, the rightward moves into Reaganism and Thatcherism, but the two schools were internally organized very differently, which had something to do with their contrasting fates. For a bunch of individualists, the Chicago school was tightly unified and conscious of its legacy, and the Charles River gang behaved more like the self-interested individuals of the free market textbooks. Here with more are Kevin Young and Leonard Seabrook, co-authors of a paper, along with Lars Folk Hendrickson, published in the Socioeconomic Review. Young teaches at UMass and Seabrook at the Copenhagen Business School. Kevin Young and Leonard Seabrook. Before we get into the practices of these two groups, could just define the ideological, you know, institutional profile of these two, the Charles River and the Chicago crowd. Who were they? What did they represent? What was their worldview?
The Chicago group is most closely associated with what folks now would consider to be kind of neoliberal economics of the time. They wanted to supplant a Keynesian neoclassical synthesis that was dominant at the time, especially among the Charles River folks. And they wanted to supplant it with more classical liberal ideas about free markets. They advanced a series of new ideas about deregulation. And they also sought to kind of expand economics into previously uncharted territory. And if you think about their work in law and economics and their work in basically what amounted to sociology, human capital theory and whatnot. But they're the free market folks very much, and they advanced ideas about monetary theory, like monetarism.
They're very much associated with the Mont Pelerin gang, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So, having said the clear idea on contracts and property rights, free market economics. I mean, having sort of an idea of, you know, an economic man as a rational actor.
It was a very comprehensive worldview. They had a very ambitious philosophy, and they wanted to change the world, right?
Absolutely. They had an incredible insurgent morality and meta-narrative about how to govern the economy that was very comprehensive, absolutely.
Yeah.
And part of that wasn't just given. Part of that was built. They built a lot of new ideas from these kind of classical liberal foundations. And as I said, expanded economics into you know, new domains of law, sociology, how to think about families, how to think about discrimination, in addition to, you know, how to think about the monetary system and how we want the state to act generically.
And sort of interesting also that they were, I mean, sort of seen sort of as underdogs by themselves. I mean, like, they're seen as kind of outsiders and, not as victims, but sort of underdogs and outsiders in the system. So they were sort of, I mean, like in part, very kind of active in trying to mobilize based on their underdog status.
And whereas the Charles River crew, Harvard, MIT, were very much the establishment in the field, but also in politics more generally, right?
Absolutely. They're very kind of ensconced in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, of course. A lot of them were folks on the Council of Economic Advisors. Samuelson was writing the dominant post-war American textbook on economics from MIT, of course. So it was a wonderful line that he had. I can't paraphrase it exactly, but once you get your ideas into the textbooks, you become practically immortal. And that must have been, the kind of sense, especially, by the 60s that a lot of these folks had in many ways. The Chicago folks, they're very well aware of this, and they sought to supplant it by their particular methods.
The kind of Keynesianism they practiced, though, was not the Keynesianism of Keynes. And whatever somewhat radical content had been in Keynes originally was largely drained from the doctrine by the time the Charles River gang were running the world with it.
Absolutely. I mean, the Charles River folks had moderated many aspects of the earlier Keynesian message. Some of them borrowed much more heavily from earlier institutionalist ideas as well. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith and Paul Samuelson are very different creatures in terms of how they understand the economy, even though they both had at various times a kind of Keynesian inflection in their work. They're very different at the same time. Yeah.
These two groups had a very different approach to academic practice, right? Yeah. Describe how Chicago organized itself in contrast with the Charles River crew.
I think in terms of what we argue in the papers is pretty accurate. You know, sort of in terms, I mean, they were pretty isolated in terms of sort of places.
Physically.
Like, fairly isolated. And there is a quote we have in the paper about it being sort of like a kind of environment like a monastery. You know, so I mean, and they were pretty isolated, and in part by intent, and linked to their own theories and their own body of science, and in part to finance also in Chicago, but really sort of seen as being sort of a separate group, and had like a pretty active idea in terms of having sort of a strong doctrine in terms of how they taught their students. I mean, a fairly interesting aspect for us in the paper, you know, I mean, they don't really argue about principles in the way that you would find kind of in left groups. Left groups, normally what we would find, you know, I mean, also now is that they tend to fracture over principles, whereas, I mean, this group has some key principles that they agree to, and they would argue on theory and around theory and ideas inside the group in a very kind of active way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the students, when they came in, were...
Some of them were social democrats.
Yeah, I was struck by that. They didn't necessarily enter. They didn't gravitate to Chicago because it was the Vatican of that style of economics, but they ended up that way. They exited that way.
Yeah, this machinery that we describe in the paper, kind of produced a lot of converts. And it wasn't just through charisma of, George Stigler and Milton Friedman, but there's a whole kind of community oriented around certain principles that was kind of very much baked into the graduate curriculum. One of the first things that Friedman did when he came in was rewrite some of the rules for graduate students to make sure that everybody studied price theory and could always, refer to that no matter what different directions they went into their work later on. They still had price theory and that certain kind of neoclassical ideas that they could always return to. So there's like a process, as Len was saying, of kind of intensive in-group socialization here at Chicago.
Yeah.
There was a debate, but it was very much debate within a doctrine. They were kind of bloodthirsty with one another at their seminars, but always within a given doctrine. And that prepared them very well and prepared their students very well for all these battles that they had within the profession, in which, as Murawski or someone else, pointed out, that people like Friedman were, more akin to, ruthless street fighters, whereas on the Charles River side of things, there's more, as it were, gentlemanly conduct in intellectual matters.
Now, was it because of their position as being dominant in the world, not merely of economics, but also politically? Was it that dominance that made them complacent, or is there not a coherent philosophy at all behind everything? How do you account for this different culture of these two schools?
In terms of what's happening at Harvard and MIT, MIT is becoming more kind of math-driven in terms of how they're operating. Harvard is more complacent, I think, in terms of how they were behaving as well. As a group together, their sort of shorthand here would be that they were behaving in a sort of piecemeal and sort of incremental scientific way. And at Chicago, you have sort of a strong doctrine and sort of a strong faith. The change in Chicago, there's kind of an intense group in how they sort of act, how they behave and act and are socialized. And having sort of a clear doctrine and sort of a clear faith almost, and having science on top of that is more effective.
I was a right winger in my early days in college, early 70s, and I recall the feeling there weren't very many of us in Yale's party of the right. There were about a dozen of us. We felt very besieged, but very righteous. And I would guess that some of that culture was felt in Chicago, very isolated, fighting what we thought was a losing battle against the victory of liberalism, but also with this sense of being righteous and on a mission, almost divinely inspired mission.
Yeah, and I know some other conversations on your show have talked about that in terms of the contemporary right and left in the United States. There's a eerie parallel there. Their moral universes were not difficult to understand, and they're extremely passionate about it. Whereas some of the Charles River folks were defending established doctrine in some ways, right? Or like, you know, defending what government policy was doing in the Great Society or many other projects at the time. That affected the tone in many ways, right?
That's the voice of Kevin Young. We're listening to him and Leonard Seabrook, co-authors of a paper on the contrasting organizational styles of the Chicago and Cambridge schools of economic thought. You study networks among these two schools. What do the networks look like? What exactly did you study and what did you trace out?
One of the networks we built was an acknowledgement network. We took all the papers that all these different academics wrote on either side of this sort of big debate and this kind of intellectual rivalry, and we took all the articles of their students, and we looked at who gets cited, not in the references, but in the acknowledgement section. So who saw the paper earlier on that got thanked and helped with the paper? And when we build these acknowledgement networks, we can use some tools from network science to measure social dynamics among these different groups of economists. One key measure that we reported on in the paper was that the level of reciprocity among the Chicago folks was much, much higher over the long term. It started out about the same, but it got much, much higher as the 60s progressed into 1980. And what that means is that they were helping each other. This is sort of evidence of their internal socialization. And they're helping each other across generations. They were working on each other's craft together. And this is in strong contrast to the Charles River folks. Either you look just at within Harvard and just within MIT, but if you group them all together, there's just much less socialization and helping within the group, whereas Chicago had a lot of it.
And Chicago also is very careful about nurturing, is a funny word to use with these people, but there was some degree of nurturance here with the graduate students. They really were careful at developing the younger talent and thinking of the longer term, and the Charles River gang did not do this.
Yeah, I mean, to the point where John Kenneth Galbraith was certainly one of the most famous economists and prominent economists in the world, certainly at the level of popular economics and big public policy discussions. He had his own TV show for a while, but didn't have many students. Folks like Friedman had many, many students. We actually went ahead and collected a lot of these folks' reference letters, and they were quite ruthless in promoting their students far and wide. But there's just more energy toward that effort in the Chicago folks. What ends up happening, that nurturing that you described, it leads to a situation where in the early 1960s, folks at Harvard and MIT, students that had just recently graduated from the program, they were citing their profs at Harvard and MIT much more than Chicago students were citing their profs, right? But over time, especially into the 70s, Chicago completely overtakes Harvard and MIT in terms of this practice, whereby students are citing their own, you know, original professors more and more. And this kind of thing arguably really matters in academia, right? Because, you know, citation practices are kind of how we acknowledge one another and kind of give energy to certain ideas over others. That's another sort of phenomenon we picked up.
But it's also an index of social ties.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, it's interesting that the chronology of this, because the 60s were the high watermark of that kind of Keynesian consensus. But then by the 70s, when we start seeing stagflation, crisis in the field, the rise of Milton Friedman, what, he became president of the AEA in, what, 76 or something like that? This is when the field was really undergoing transformation. So as they're having this real-world crisis plus the reorganization at the real-world level, they are also showing more internal coherence and solidarity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's clearly a kind of very convenient opportunity structure for them to make a lot of their important professional moves in the 70s. But exactly, you're exactly right. They were coherent and they were able to kind of propagate and spread across generations in a way that was super useful to this period of stagflation and also obviously debate and dissensus within economics generally in the 70s. There's all kinds of stuff going on, obviously, by the mid and late 70s.
Could you say that there was anything of a coherent worldview around the Charles River crew other than just tweaks to the status quo? Is there some broad philosophy, worldview that united them in any way other than their association with these two prestigious departments?
One thing that they tended to emphasize, obviously, just in contrast to Chicago, was there's certainly more akin to emphasize a market failure over government failure. That's one key thing. The kind of appetite for government intervention and the appetite for government regulation is much, much higher. And they have arguably a kind of theory of the state, which is much more generous in terms of, you know, what the state can do for social welfare through various economic interventions than the Chicago folks had as well. But I mean, you're hitting on something here already is that the kind of Keynesian neoclassical synthesis had many different variants, even during the kind of high watermark of this tradition. And it's not like they could all reach to the general theory, for certain kinds of answers in a way that was always going to lead to sort of social cohesion. So there was differences among them intellectually. But we shouldn't also overemphasize the idea that Chicago folks were on the same page about certain things. They also had all kinds of ruthless debates among one another. But they did, as you hinted at, they did kind of have kind of common principles down to the kind of microeconomic level. So like, you know, down to the level of human behavior and what markets are, how information works. And the Charles River folks didn't quite have that together.
The Chicago people had a vision of how to understand the world, right? So you have Gary Becker talking about marriage at the same time.
Yeah. You've got
others talking about the financial markets. They had a finger in many, many pies.
Yeah, George Stigler really kind of promoted and wrote about, as I'm sure you know, the idea of economics imperialism, not the economics of imperialism, but economics as an imperial social science.
Yeah.
And they were remarkably successful in this regard as well. I mean, if you think of how public policy was transformed through folks like Peltzman and Stigler, how we think about regulatory capture and the nature of the state. Think of like James Buchanan and folks like that coming out of Chicago and the whole public choice tradition. And then Gary Becker and other people he attached to Columbia, like Jacob Mincer, advanced this idea of human capital that transformed the way people thought about labor markets, about discrimination. And then, of course, there's the other branches related to efficient markets and finance and monetary theory at large.
How much of this coherence in the Chicago circle was the result of their association with a broader political movement? You know, we mentioned Mont Pelerin. There's also movement conservatism that was growing at that time. How much was that a factor?
I mean, a fairly important factor, we think, sort of in the paper. It's really sort of important on this sort of aimed behavior. The important trend for us in terms of what we find in the paper is that, the forms of cohesion that they have in the early period, before stagflation and before,
Thatcherism and Reaganism all happened later.
That's all later. So, sort of our story on cohesion is really sort of important in being prior to the external effects in terms of what's happening with Thatcher and similar.
And Mont Pelerin were important in kind of giving these folks energy and all kinds of transnational connections.
Yeah.
In affirming certain beliefs, of course, but also, working out ideas that would be, akin to strategy, connecting with others transnationally. The story of the neoliberal ascent is not just the story of the Mont Pelerin Society, we think. There's also something very special going on with a particular department at a particular university as well, and their kind of internal practices. They got energy from the Mont Pelerin Society. They helped them project a lot of their ideas. in various places.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what was going on in the department and how it functioned was probably a bit more key. And then, you know, they connected to the conservative movement more generally. Of course, it's in the 70s that more and more connections to think tanks start to emerge. But, you know, to a certain extent, this is a period where the right doesn't have the conservative movement, the U.S., doesn't have all of its, it doesn't have its house in order exactly. They helped advance, I think, the conservative movement in the United States more than the conservative movement helped them. The ascendant conservatism that we see emerge in the very late 70s and early 80s, of course, also kind of fuses with a kind of religious conservatism in the U.S., you know, sort of plus some of these neoliberal economic ideas. The Chicago Economist didn't have anything to do at all with that fusion, but they provided obviously the key ingredients and the key kind of legitimacy to the economic program that was very important. Yeah.
Now, do we have anything analogous going on today? I mean, what's the situation in Chicago like? Is it still a disciplined school of thought, or has it become less coherent? And is there any kind of new formation that might be rivaling the existing power structure in the same way that Chicago did 50 years ago?
Not that I know of. there's some amazing economics departments out there. I mean, Chicago has become more pluralistic than it was in many ways. My contemporary understanding of that department is less strong than the kind of historical understanding. But there's, you know, there's obviously all kinds of different intellectual movements within economics, some of which have been more successful than others. But I don't think you can point to the same kind of cohesive doctrinaire energy and moral certainty.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm interested in what you might think, Doug. The kind of movement of the behavioralists in economics. You think of like the Nudgers and folks like that, or folks bringing in behavioral psychology in. You know, they've had some important successes. They've gotten a lot of their ideas sort of translated into whole government programs and departments and stuff. But it's not the same kind of movement and effort. And of course, there's
It's not very inspiring nor transformative.
Right, right. I mean, it's much more modest in its expectations.
One's not going to go to the barricades for Cass Sunstein.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
Those were Kevin Young and Leonard Seabrook, co-authors of a paper along with Lars Fogh Henriksen, Intellectual Rivalry in American Economics, Intergenerational Social Cohesion, and the Rise of the Chicago School, published in the Socioeconomic Review. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a somewhat topical song, despite being from 1995, by Six Finger Satellite, Simian Fever. Till next week, bye.
Doctor, there's trouble in the monkey house.
What is it, Mr. Marburg?
I think it's Simian fever, 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 simian fever.